Good morning, and it's time for conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. It's going to be a chilly WIP day out there, maybe going no higher than 37 degrees. So matter where you go, take WIP with you. Always hot conversation. And when we come back in just a bit, we're going to talk about your eyes, how they see, why they see, what we do about seeing problems. All this and more when we come back here on 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon, the WIP time, 6:03. And we're back. It's conversation. My conversation this morning is with John Dowling. John is one of the authors of a book, along with his brother. That new book talks about eyes, vision, how it works, and what we can do, what we do wrong with it. Good morning, John Dowling.
Good morning.
Okay.
You awakened me early this morning.
Awakened myself early, too, but that's another discussion. All right, John, how did you get into this business of eyes? I mean, you're a researcher at Harvard University, right? Yeah.
Right. Okay, let me tell you, I maybe head back even a little bit further. Young boy growing up, I was always interested in science things, how things work, and I used to make all sorts of things. My father was a physician, actually an ophthalmologist, and when I went off to college, I went to Harvard, I majored in biology with the thought that I would become a physician, like my father. But it was not my father's influence, or even my brother, who is an ophthalmologist as well, that brought me into vision, but a professor I had when I was a junior. He was a biochemist. His name was George Wald, and he had discovered the role of vitamin A in vision. And he taught biochemistry and was a wonderful teacher. The first semester usually talked about the great metabolic pathways, which if any of your listeners have been through that kind of a course, it can get very tedious, very uninteresting at times. But Wald brought it to life. He was mesmerizing without any question. Then in the second semester, he had a course called Topics in Biochemistry, and he talked about fascinating things. One that remains with me to this day is his description of Albert St. George's experiments on muscle fibers. St. George discovered vitamin C and had won a Nobel Prize for that. But when he came to this country in the late 40s, he began working on muscle. And what he showed was that if you take a piece of muscle from a rabbit or a frog, and you extract all the small molecules from the muscle, which can be easily done with something like glycerol, you have a piece of inner tissue. But if you put back on that tissue an energy-rich molecule called ATP, the muscle would contract. And when I heard that story, I was just fascinated. It seemed to me to be getting at the essence of life. So at that point, I approached Professor Wald and said, could I do some research in your laboratory? I had never done any before, and he accepted me into the laboratory, and that changed my life. That was, again, between my junior and senior years at Harvard, and the senior year, I spent almost the entire year in his laboratory doing research, and I found it very exciting. I then went off to medical school, but used to come back on odd afternoons and in the summer between the first and second year of medical school. And after 2 years, which is the preclinical years in medical school, I decided to take a leave of absence to come back and do research full-time for 1 year. Hopefully, I thought, to get the research bug out of my system. Well, I took a leave of absence. That was 50 years ago, and I'm still doing research and enjoying it enormously. So that may be more of an answer than you wanted, but it sort of gives you a feeling of how I got into research, who was most important in my life and doing that and so on and so forth.
Now, you and your brother wrote this book. Was it easy or hard?
Yes, we did it together. My brother was an ophthalmologist, like my father, and he became an ophthalmologist because he found ophthalmology a very challenging specialty encompassing many aspects of medicine, from surgery to diagnosis to prevention to chronic conditions and so on and so forth. And, of course, over the years, we stayed in touch, but I was interested in basic science. How does the eye work, particularly the retina of the eye, which sits in the back of the eye, and that's where vision starts. At the very back of the eye are the photoreceptors, the cells that absorb the light and initiate the process of vision. But in addition to the photoreceptors, the retina, which sits in the back of the eye, which is a true piece of the brain actually pushed out into the eye during development, consists of another four or five types of neurons that start the processing of the visual image. And that's what I've spent most of my career studying. How does the retina work? I use the retina and the eye as a model piece of the brain, trying to understand how the cells that receive input from the photoreceptors are wired together, how they pass on that information to second-order cells, and then how the second-order cells pass on the information to third-order cells. And it's the third-order cells whose long axonal processes, these are the processes that neurons extend and carry information, how those processes gather at the optic nerve and carry the visual message from the eye to the rest of the brain. And so, you know, over the years, I've been interested then in the wiring of the retina, the physiology of the retina, how do the cells respond when light activates the photoreceptors, then the pharmacology. What are the molecules? What are the substances that neurons in the retina use to communicate with one another? Then more recently, I've been interested in the genetics of the retina and so on and so forth. So how did this book come about? Well, in 2008, I was approached by the chairman of the board of the Lasker Foundation of New York, who, in conjunction with the International Retinal Research Foundation, were starting an initiative looking at the major eye diseases and what we might do to accelerate progress in understanding these diseases. And when I said, why me? I'm not a clinician. They said, we think that somehow we need to bring together the basic science and the clinicians to really move things forward. So I accepted the chairmanship of that initiative, and it lasted for 10 years until 2018. It just finished a year ago. And during those 10 years, we did studies on four major topics. The first one was on glaucoma and the possible role of glial cells in that disease. So we did four studies, each of which took 2 years. We gathered together the best people that we could find in basic science who were interested in this disease, the best people we could find in the clinical sciences in this area, and others that we thought might contribute substantially. And so we had workshops and then a final plenary session in the following spring, and from that we wrote a report. So in total, we wrote four reports, the first one on glaucoma, the second one on diabetic retinopathy, the third one on restoring vision to the blind, and then the last one, the fourth one, on amblyopia, the loss of vision when the two eyes are not seeing properly, and that can be caused by crossed eyes or cataract or something like that. And in the course of that 10 years, I appreciated then how important it was that basic science and the clinical science just get together and discuss their mutual interests and what needs to be done. So towards the end of that 10 years, I thought, gee, we should write a small book for the public, for the basic scientist who wants to know more about eye diseases, and for the clinician who wants to know more about our present understanding of basic visual mechanisms. So I started the book. I was on a leave in Germany. This was back in 2013. And as I was writing it, I came to realize I really needed some expertise on the clinical side. So when I came back from Germany with a very rough draft of what I wanted to do, I approached my brother and said, let's do this together. And that's the way the book started. And it's a unique book in the following senses. There are very few books out there that really try to combine basic science of a set of diseases that occur in a particular area of the body and the clinical sciences, and that is accessible both for the basic scientists, the clinical scientists, and even the public. So that was the origin of the book. And we had a good time doing it, many arguments, but we survived it, and I think the book came out fairly well.
So you don't need a PhD in clinical chemistry or biology to read the book?
That's exactly what we aim for. You do not. We tried to stay out of the weeds, both on the clinical side and on the basic science side, to make it accessible to people who've had essentially no more than high school science, a little chemistry, a little physics, and when I say a little, I mean a very little. And so that was the idea. But you see, we all at some point, you know, have visual problems as we age. I mean, the obvious one is farsightedness that we all get because our lenses aren't as good in focusing images onto the photoreceptors on the retina. And so we all end up, virtually everyone end up having to wear glasses. But then there are other major eye diseases that affect people as they age or even as younger people that we try to deal with today and fairly successfully. So, for example, many people develop cataracts, and today in the West, cataract surgery is phenomenal. We'll come back and discuss some of the great advances there, if you would like, later on. But then age-related macular degeneration, where the center of the eye and that area called the fovea, which is so critical for high-resolution vision, when that gets diseased, and again, it's age-related macular degeneration. What can we do about that? Can we help that? And so on and so forth. So, you know, and then diabetic retinopathy, which is an offshoot of diabetes, is also a problem for many people as they age, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, accidents to the eye, retinal detachment, which can be dealt with today very successfully, and so on and so forth. So it was with all of that in mind that we wrote the book. We made it short, and we hope in language that everybody can understand with just a little science background. And, you know, I hope it is useful. Again, I think it is unique in that there are very few books that really relate to clinical and the basic sciences of major parts of the body that, as we age, run into difficulties.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning is John D. Dowling, professor, research professor of neurosciences at the Department of
Molecular
and Cellular Biology at Harvard University, and one of the authors of the new book with his brother, that new book being Vision, How It Works and What Can Go Wrong. My name's Peter Solomon. Now, doctor, you mentioned glaucoma.
Right.
I remember my grandmother, when I was little, had these Coke bottle glasses. And I was told that they were related to glaucoma. Is that true?
They can be, but she probably had very severe myopia, that is nearsightedness, which required very strong glasses. And clearly myopia is a risk factor for glaucoma. But the biggest risk factor for glaucoma is increased pressure in the eye. And so the way it's treated today is, of course, to put drops in the eye that lower the intraocular pressure. And that's quite successful. It doesn't work for everybody, but for many people with glaucoma, the therapies that we presently have to lower eye pressure work quite well and over long periods of time. My guess is also another risk factor for glaucoma is cataract surgery, but that's diminishing because we've been so successful in modifying how cataract surgery is done. Cataracts are the leading cause of blindness in the world. The surgery to deal with cataracts goes way back in history. Initially, it was done by ophthalmologists taking a little needle, putting it in the eye to dislodge the lens of the eye, which is where the cataract is. It's the clouding of the lens that make it difficult for images to fall on the photoreceptors that is the underlying basis of cataracts. And initially it was to get rid of the lens that was the problem. The lens was just attached, and then the lens fell to the bottom of the eye. Now, what was the result was that people who had severe cataracts and were having difficulty seeing anything now all of a sudden had much more light flooding into the eye. Unfortunately, without a lens, then the focus was poor. So at that point, you needed to wear very, very thick glasses. But even more recently then, what surgeons learned to do is to go into the eye, and this was even in my father's time at the beginning of the 20th century, is you could go into the eye with fine surgical tools and remove the lens. And that, again, was a real step forward when you could remove the lens surgically. But today, we are in an amazing situation with regard to cataract surgery. For example, no longer do you need to remove the lens, but you can emulsify it with ultrasound. It's called phacoemulsification. And so you essentially get rid of the lens by sucking out the lens that you have emulsified, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And another huge advance is the use of now of artificial lenses that you can insert into the eye. That's an interesting story. I just recounted for your readers. It actually goes back to the Second World War when an ophthalmologist in southern England, a man by the name of Harold Ridley, was visited one day by a fighter pilot who came into his office and said, "Doc," I said, "you know, about 6 or 8 months ago, when on a mission over Germany, a bullet hit my windshield and a piece of plastic flew off and entered my eye. It never really bothered me, but I thought maybe I ought to talk to somebody about whether it should be removed or not." So Ridley looked into his eye and was astonished to see a sizable piece of plastic in his eye, but that the eye tolerated that piece of plastic extraordinarily well. There was no immune reaction to the piece of plastic. It seemed to be perfectly happy there in the eye. And he thought, gee, maybe what we can do is make artificial lenses with plastic and insert them in place of the removed eye, of the removed lens. And so he worked on that and eventually came up with something that works extraordinarily well. So today, if you have a cataract.
Hello? And you're listening to...
And it requires such a small incision, you don't even need stitches. In other words, with the ultrasound, you emulsify the lens so that you can then suck it out with a very fine, what we call pipette, and then you can insert in the little tiny incision the plastic lens that then can be put in and replace the lens that was there to begin with. But it can go on, it goes on even further than that, in that they now have some lenses that can change their shape. You can see near or far with the artificial lenses. More often what is done is if it's a bilateral cataract procedure, and because if you get a cataract in one eye, you tend to get a cataract in the other eye, is what you can do is put a lens in one eye that allows you to achieve near, i.e. reading and recognizing faces and so on and so forth. And in the other eye, you put a lens in that allows you to see things at some distance away for driving and what have you. And so you can use one eye for reading, the other eye for long-distance vision. It's really remarkable. I remember my father talking about cataract surgery in his day. This goes back into the 1920s. And he said, you know, that was a major operation at that point, at least as far as eye surgery was concerned. And so after we did a cataract surgery, we made the patient stay in bed for 4 days with the head immobilized so that, you know, that there was no problem with the eye healing. Today, it's done in 20 minutes and you're on your way in another 10 or 15 minutes. It's really astonishing. That's one of the real great success stories in ophthalmology, cataract surgery. Unfortunately, of course, in many third world countries, they don't have the surgeons that available to remove the cataracts, but they're beginning to even teach nurse practitioners how to do the procedure so that cataract surgery is becoming more and more available throughout the world. But if there was a way we could stop the cataract formation, and there are basic scientists working on this, it would be a great advance.
Now, I've had people in my family who've had cataract problems. And
right.
They talked about you have to wait for the cataract to ripen. What's that?
Well, because cataract surgery used to be, a difficult procedure when you had to remove the whole lens and so on and so forth, eye surgeons didn't want to remove the cataract, the lens that was cloudy, until vision was very poor. That's changed today. In other words, if a patient comes to an ophthalmic surgeon and says, gee, doc, you know, I'm having problems seeing things as clearly as I used to, but I can still read to some extent, and I can do this and that and so on and so forth, the physician will say, let's do the cataract surgery. We'll get rid of the cloudy lens, put in the artificial lens, and it's really an optional surgical procedure, one that though improves your quality of life. So it used to be that until the cloudiness of the lens was so severe and was called ripe, that the surgeon wouldn't operate. But that's not the case today.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah, it is a tremendous advance. But there are many other advances that we've also had in ophthalmology. I sound like a clinician, which I am not, but, I see what is going on. So, for example, it used to be that retinal detachment was a huge problem. That is, if you're hit on the side of the head or an eye has a contusion, that means something hard hits it, often the retina will come off the back of the eye. And when that happens, because the retina, particularly the photoreceptors, depend on the back of the eye for nutrition, oxygen, and so on and so forth, vision is lost in that part of the retina. And if one part of the retina comes off the back of the eye, a good deal of the rest of the retina may also come off the back of the eye. Well, today with lasers, what you can do is tack the retina back on to the back of the eye, and it works very, very effectively. The first treatment for retinal detachment used to be to make the eye a little smaller so that the back of the eye was pushed back towards the retina rather than the retina being pushed back on the back of the eye. That was a heroic technique developed by a man by the name of Charles Scapins in Boston and worked surprisingly well. But it was a long operation, a tedious operation, and not always successful. Today, with lasers surgery, it's almost a trivial procedure and extraordinarily successful. So I just talked about a couple of advances that have been made over the last half century or even a little longer that have made a huge difference. And, of course, things are going on all the time that are advancing things. So, for example, we know of a number of inherited eye diseases. One of the most common, although it's fairly rare, fortunately, is called retinitis pigmentosa. And what happens there is that the photoreceptors, and we have two types of photoreceptors, rods, which mediate our dim light vision, and cones, which operate during the day, so they're responsive to brighter lights, but they also mediate our color vision. And in retinitis pigmentosa, first it's the rods that disappear, but eventually the cones go too. Well, the genes which cause that inherited disease have been identified, and it turned out, much to our surprise, that there are many, many genes that are mutated that cause this disease. But it suggested that we can, by replacing a particular gene, be able to cure that inherited disease. And the first gene therapy was just approved a year or so ago by the FDA, and now is being successfully used to treat that form of inherited retinal blindness. And though that's a huge advance, it's one of the first successful gene therapies in any branch of medicine. So that's been a great, great advance, and it's the kind of thing that's going on. I mean, we're even beginning to deal with complete blindness with what we call visual prostheses. That is, when the photoreceptors have degenerated, of course, then there's no longer any vision because there's nothing to receive the light or absorb the light. And visual prostheses, that is, little devices that are photosensitive, can be put into the eye. They stimulate the retinal circuitry that remains. It's just the photoreceptors in many cases that have degenerated. And so we can restore some vision that way. Doesn't give you the high-resolution vision yet that we're all hoping we can provide to people who are completely blind. But what's astonishing is people who haven't seen any light, anything, for 10 or 15 years, when given this device, it's implanted in their eyes, now can see light. Resolution is not all that good so far, but it's coming along. But they can avoid large objects, and so for their visual situation, it's a huge improvement. And there are many other techniques that are coming along in the basic science laboratories that we think will be equally important, if not more important, in restoring vision to the blind. There's a technique called optogenetics, in which a gene is inserted into the eye that renders cells in the eye photosensitive. It can be remaining photoreceptors if there are any left, but it can also be the second order neurons or even the third order neurons that one can make light sensitive. And that's not in the clinic yet. It's getting close to the clinic. But then other basic scientists are trying to transplant cells back into an eye in which certain cells have deteriorated, degenerated photoreceptors and other cells in the eye. And indeed, there's great interest in using stem cells, of course, stem cells which can form any kind of cell, putting those into the eye and seeing if one can get those stem cells to replace cells in the eye that have degenerated. So, there's lots going on, and we're making an enormous amount of progress. And all of this we cover in the book. With a fairly light hand, if you will, that is, to make it accessible to the public and to as far as the basic science is concerned, palatable for the clinician, and as far as the clinical side of things, palatable for the basic scientist.
And you're listening to Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. My guest this morning, John Dowling, clinical professor at Harvard University.
Not a clinical professor. I'm what is called a neuroscientist, a research professor in basic neuroscience. My brother is the clinician.
Okay. Thank you for that correction.
I sound like a clinician this morning, but that's because I've read the book.
Well, that's good. And you're listening to 94 WIP. My name's Peter Solomon. Now, doctor, I had a nephew who in his early 30s developed eye cancer. What can you tell us about that and that as a possibility?
What is his disability?
Eye cancer.
Eye cancer.
Yeah, cancer in the eye.
Yeah, okay. This I am not an expert on, and we really don't cover that in the book. But it depends on how invasive the cancer is. If it's very invasive, then the eye has to be taken out. But fortunately, cancers in the eye are usually localized to the eye, and so it then stops, although you lose one eye. If they're smaller lesions, smaller tumors, then various radiation techniques can be used to kill the cancerous cells, and people can do very well with that. The proton beam technique developed a number of years ago has been very successful in dealing with such small tumors, and then the eye is saved for the most part. There may be a small lesion left in the eye, but the person still has the eye, still can use it for seeing.
Which is what they did for him.
Yes. So that's what they did for him?
Yes.
Yeah, proton beam. That's been a great success. That was developed mainly by a clinician at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary here in Boston.
Boston really sounds like it's a center for research and intervention in eye work.
But there are many centers of research. The gene therapy development has mainly has happened in Philadelphia at the University of Pennsylvania Eye Hospital. They've been some of the leading people there in learning how to do gene therapy. And a leading person there is a former postdoctoral fellow of mine named Gus Aguirre. He's a veterinarian, and he has a group of dogs there at the University of Pennsylvania who have mutations that are identical to mutations that one sees in humans. And indeed, one of the the first dog that was cured with gene therapy was called Lancelot. That was a good decade or more ago, and really showed that this could work. And he's been now treating other dogs that have loss of cone vision, that are colorblind, with gene therapy and so on and so forth. So it's not only in Boston, but it's all over the country. And I think that the greatest advances in gene therapy have actually been made in your city, in Philadelphia.
Do you have any thoughts on Philadelphia's Will's Eye Hospital?
On Will's?
Yes.
It's an excellent hospital, very, very good hospital. So you've got two great hospitals with important and very productive ophthalmology departments in Philadelphia, the Wills and, of course, then the University of Pennsylvania. But we have other centers. The Wilner Institute in Baltimore is a superb eye center. The Baskin-Palmer in Miami is another great eye center. And another one that comes to mind, the University of Utah has a wonderful eye center, the Moran Center. And on the West Coast, you have the Jules Stein Institute. And in San Francisco, you have the University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. Eye department is excellent as well. And so it's not just in Boston. Of course, that's where I am and know more about what's going on than other places. But there's certainly many superb places for vision research. University of Michigan is another example, the Kellogg Institute there, and so on and so forth.
Nothing wrong with a little Boston pride there, sir.
Nothing wrong with a little Boston pride.
Absolutely.
That's right. We haven't had a bad sports year, kid.
Nope, no indeed.
But the Red Sox and the Patriots, so, but that's a conversation for another day.
Absolutely. Tell me about diabetic retinopathy.
Okay, well, of course, the great risk factor there is diabetes. And a small percentage of people will develop a retinopathy. And that retinopathy is mainly the production of blood vessels that shouldn't be there. And that will destroy vision because these blood vessels tend to be very fragile and they leak, causing hemorrhages in the eye. So what causes the diabetic retinopathy? We really don't know. My own view is that it relates to oxygen availability in the eye. And why I say that is the following. And that is that the retina is a huge consumer of oxygen, particularly the photoreceptors. So, and interestingly enough, they consume more oxygen in the dark than they do in the light. And why we think, then, that it's related to the high metabolism of the retina, and why in diabetes, when you have high glucose, you have this very high metabolic demand by the cells. We don't know why that is, but if you... What we do know, for example, and this is an interesting story, if you have retinitis pigmentosa, which I talked about a few minutes ago, in which the rods are first badly damaged, and the rods are found mainly in the periphery of the eye, not in the center, which mediates our highest resolution, when the rods die, it reduces, of course, the metabolic demand of the eye. And these people, even though they have severe diabetes, don't develop diabetic retinopathy. So that was the first hint that indeed it's the need for oxygen in the eye because of its high metabolic demand that related to diabetic retinopathy. And indeed, a treatment was developed a number of years ago that's still used, in which what you do is take a laser and you damage a good deal of the retina outside of the central area. So you damage the peripheral retina, And why do you do that? To treat diabetic retinopathy, to reduce the metabolic demand of the retina. And that works reasonably well. But of course, today, what we try to make sure is that anyone who has diabetes is maintained on strict glucose control, and that helps a lot. And again, with laser therapy and then the glucose control, one can help a lot of diabetic retinopathy. So we don't really have a way to completely cure it, but we have some ways to modify it, moderate it, and allow people to maintain vision for a good period of time.
Does it ever reverse, though, if you've had diabetes, but at some point you get it under control?
Yeah. I mean, we do have treatments now to reduce the growth of abnormal blood vessels. There's a compound called VEGF that induces in retinal disease the formation of abnormal blood vessels and blood vessels that shouldn't be there. And now we have a number of ways of reducing that molecule that enhances the blood vessel formation, anti-VEGF treatments, and that's used now in diabetic retinopathy and can be very helpful. It's also used in age-related macular degeneration. In age-related macular degeneration, it comes in two forms. One is what is called a dry form, in which you have lesions in the central retina that affect particularly your high-resolution vision and your color vision to a considerable extent. The dry form, though, is relatively benign. It takes a long time, usually, not always, but usually, for vision to be severely compromised. On the other hand, about 15% of the cases of dry AMD go on to a more severe form of AMD called wet AMD. And what is meant by that? The wet AMD situation is that has blood vessel growth in the central area of the retina. And again, what can happen is those new vessels tend to be fragile. They leak, and you have hemorrhage. And if you have hemorrhage in the center of the eye, then you lose all high-resolution vision. You can't read. You can't drive. You can't watch television. So the way that's treated today, again, is applying these anti-VEGF compounds to the eye. And that really doesn't cure the disease, but it slows down enormously the progression of the degeneration. And for many people, they can the anti-VEGF treatment has been a real miracle for them. Again, you're not curing the disease, and this is what we need to get at, and that is what's causing age-related macular degeneration. A number of us have ideas, and we're exploring what might be done to actually stop the disease, to prevent it, to cure it. But we're not there yet. The anti-VEGF treatment, though, slows it way down, and for many people, even stabilizes their vision for a good period of time, if not permanently.
Okay, we're running out of time, doctor, so let me do a little housekeeping thing here. Do you have a website?
I don't. Well, you would contact me by looking on my name at Harvard University. I don't have a separate website. Okay. But if you look at the Harvard University Faculty of Arts and Sciences, Department of Molecular and Cellular Biology, then you would come upon my website. That's correct.
And we can hopefully find your book both on...
You can find it on Amazon. It was published by the MIT Press, so it should be readily available. Again, it's Vision, How It Works and What Can Go Wrong. It's a small book. It's only 170 pages, hopefully accessible to anybody interested in eye disease or how we see, because we spent most of the time today talking about diseases of the eye. But understanding how we see all the way up to visual perception is included in the book, and I think it's a fascinating story.
Absolutely. And certainly we can hopefully find your book at Barnes Noble as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, now one final question.
Sure.
You say it's important to have a routine eye exam. Why?
Well, because a lot of situations arise that you're not even aware of. So, for example, where the optic nerve, the axons, which I talked about very early on, exit the eye and carry the visual message from the eye to the rest of the brain, there are no photoreceptors there. There's a blind spot there, but we don't notice it. We fill it in. That's done in the cortex, in the brain, and in the brain proper rather than the eye. Now, why I mention it is that glaucoma, when it starts in the periphery of the retina, and you can lose a substantial amount of vision in part of the retina, and you don't even notice it. So sometimes glaucoma is talked about as the thief in the night. By that, it means that you don't realize that you're losing vision. So just for glaucoma, it's useful then to have an eye exam every year to make sure something like that isn't happening. And the initial stages of retinitis pigmentosa, very difficult to detect. Because if you have two eyes, the so-called blind spot in one eye is covered by the other eye. And so you don't see that there's a defect there. And if you're having any trouble with, your acuity as you get older, by 40, almost all of us need glasses for reading, and you don't want to strain your eyes by, trying to read something that really is should be dealt with by wearing reading glasses and so on and so forth. So it's a good idea to have an eye exam every year to test the pressure of the eye, to see if there's anything else going on in the eye. And that's one of the great beauties of the eye and the retina. You can look in and see what's happening there and indeed pick up diseases that may affect vision very early on before they become a problem.
And I'd like to say thank you to John Dowling, one of the authors of the new book, that new book on eye health and eye disease, Vision, How It Works and What Can Go Wrong, by John Dowling and his brother Joseph Dowling Jr. Thank you, sir.
Right. Good.
Been my pleasure.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
I enjoyed it, and I hope your listeners enjoy it as well.
Thank you. And
okay.
You're welcome. And it's been another edition of Conversation here on 94 WIPL Sports Radio. My name's Peter Solomon. Stay tuned for WIP Sunday. It's cold out there. It's going to go up to like 37, so no matter where you go, take 94 WIP with you. Always hot conversation here on 94 WIP. Thank you to Phil Jackson, this morning's producer. Nothing left to say, but see you soon.